Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you'll hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is important that it is presented each week on This Week in Palestine. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. And this is your host, John Roberts. The Great March of Return continues in Gaza, as does the slaughter by the Israeli snipers who openly shoot at protesters walking toward the wall that imprisons them in Gaza. Several of the protesters have died, but mostly the snipers shoot to maim, aiming at feet and legs. When one thinks of the barbarity by Israel, which imprisons Gazans behind a huge wall, and have their soldiers shoot unarmed protesters when they get too close to that precious wall. In a moment you will hear Ahmed Abu Artema, a founder of the Great March of Return, but first I want to read an excerpt from Jen Marlowe, a journalist who writes in Mondeweis, describing her experience on one of these historic marches to the wall. And here I quote, "I stared at Youssef al-Daye's selfie. High cheekbones, light brown hair, much of it under a baseball cap, thick eyebrows slightly raised, lending an air of surprise to an otherwise pensive, soulful 14-year-old face. The Great March earlier that day had been a blur of action. Ribbons of tear gas and repeated bursts of live fire, sometimes followed by shouts of, 'Someone's wounded!' Was the last of these incidents that I witnessed the moment that Youssef had been shot in the chest and killed? That afternoon, Fadi and I headed to Malacca, east of Gaza City, so that I could observe the Great Return March. The weekly demonstrations at the barrier separating Gaza from Israel began on March 30th, protesting the Israeli siege on Gaza and demanding the right of Palestinian refugees to return to their native villages. According to Al-Mezan, Center for Human Rights, nearly 200 Palestinians have been killed since the start of the march, and over 14,000 others wounded. Fadi buckled his flak jacket as we walked towards the lush green fields on which the separation fence had been erected. Fruit, vegetables, and olive groves had once grown here, Fadi explained to me. But in recent years, Israeli soldiers shot at farmers they deemed too close to the barrier. Farmers began growing wheat, which required little maintenance aside from planting and harvesting, thus reducing their risk. Since the start of the demonstrations, however, the fields could not be used for agriculture at all. The demonstration had yet to get fully underway. A few hundred people, the majority of them children, girls and young women among them, hurled stones towards a metal fence approximately 150 meters away as Israeli army jeeps drove back and forth along the dirt road and just beyond. You see those mounds of dirt? Fadi pointed to. They look like massive anthills. That's where snipers are. Two boys, no older than 11 or 12, carried tires to further fuel a plume of black smoke as a distinctive pop and sizzle of tear gas canisters permeated the air. And then a sharper crack. Live fire, Fadi said. A moment later, the protesters all dashed towards one spot as shouts of, "Someone's wounded!" rang out. I zoomed my video camera on the mass of youth. Moments later, medics emerged from the crowd carrying a young man on a stretcher. I caught a quick look at his bloodied leg as a stretcher passed us en route to a waiting ambulance. Media cameras jostled each other to get better view as the medics loaded the youth onto the ambulance. I turned my attention to a field. A handful of kids were running closer to the barrier, darting back and forth when tear gas enveloped them. One teenager triumphantly grabbed a freshly shot canister, gas still spouting forth, and hurled it back towards the jeeps. I was so intent on filming this moment that I almost missed the sound of live fire, followed once again by calls of, "Someone's wounded!" I shifted my camera towards the demonstrators running to the site of the injury, with the medics emerging with the wounded on a stretcher. A young man with brown Adidas shirt caught my eye. I noticed his metal crutches immediately, but it took me a moment to realize that his right jeans leg was pinned up above the knee. He agreed to an interview, wrapping a black and white keffiyeh around his face to conceal his identity. His name was Atala, he tells us, and he was 18 years old. He had lost his leg at this very encampment on April 13, 2018. He returned to the protest 4 months later after his release from the hospital. He comes to encourage the other youth to protest and to cross the barrier. "They're afraid of the occupation," he said. "You're not scared?" I asked him. "No, I'm not afraid of death. I'm only afraid of God." Atala insisted that his life has not changed at all since the amputation of his leg. Even when Fadi pressed the question, no, it's just the same as before. I'm moving, I'm running, I'm walking, the same as anyone else." Atala made his way on his crutches towards a group of children and youth slinging stones with slingshots at an armored car, black smoke billowing. Approximately 4 p.m., the sound of more live fire. I directed my camera towards the cry of, "There's an injury," when a tear gas canister landed a few meters behind us. The wind carried the gas in our direction. Eyes burning, Fadi and I decided it was time to leave. We headed to his car, passing a group of chanting adults marching towards the field. The numbers had swelled to several thousand since our arrival. That was an excerpt from a Mondo Weiss article written by Jen Marlowe, describing the scene at the weekly Great March of Return in Gaza. And now we will hear from one of the founders of the Great March of Return, who was on tour in the United States and recently spoke at the Harvard Law School. Ahmed Abu Adama is a Palestinian journalist and peace activist. He's the author of the book Organized Chaos, and he has written several articles. He's a refugee from Al Ramla village in Palestine. Here is Ahmed Abu Adama with introductory statements from the moderator, Amal Bishara, professor at Tufts University.
Thank you all for being here this evening, a really, really special and important evening for us as a community. I'm going to start with a few welcomes and thank yous and also some ground rules. I'll start with the ground rules first. First of all, I want to just, you know, this is, of course, fundamentally, in one way, an event about freedom of expression, about the bold protest that has been going on in Palestine for almost a year now. Of course, freedom of expression is an issue that we all need to protect and cultivate here at Harvard Law School as well. So with that in mind, I would ask the audience to refrain from interrupting today's event. Filming or recording this event is prohibited unless you've been given express permission by the organizers. And obviously, we want to show each other respect as we're in this important space together. So thank you all for being a part of this conversation in that way. I want to welcome you all and thank you for being here, and especially also thank our incredible organizers, the Palestinian Caucus at Harvard Kennedy School, the There's a lot of them, so hold your applause. Palestine Solidarity Committee, Harvard Law School Justice for Palestine, the Palestinian Community of Boston, Jewish Voice for Peace Boston, United for Justice with Peace, Massachusetts Peace Action, the Alliance for Water Justice, American Friends Service Committee, and a special thanks to some of the people who've been putting in so much organizing effort, particularly Randa Wahbi, Jihad Abu Salim with the AFSC, Reem Jafari, and Asma Jaber. So we're very grateful for all the effort that allowed us to be here today. I also want to start by recognizing that, of course, Harvard University is located on the lands of Wampanoag, Pawtucket, and Massachusetts tribal nations, and that, of course, the U.S. settler colonial project continues here and continues to do violence to indigenous lives and lands. Just as we think about the way in which the Nakba continues in Palestine, we need to think about the toll that settler colonialism takes right here on the ground where we are gathered. This history and this present must inform our approach to learning, expression, and activism here in Cambridge and beyond. It is truly, truly a deep honor to be here, invited to introduce Ahmed Aburthema, a journalist, a poet, activist, father, author of the book Organized Chaos, which I need to get my hands on, published, as many of you know, in The Nation, The New York Times, The Journal of Palestine Studies, Al Jazeera, among many, many, many other outlets. And of course, also the founder of the Great March of Return. I don't want to say too much here, but I do want to just mark how important this is as a community for us to be greeting you here today. So I will say a few words. Ahmed Aburthema was born in 1984. When he was born, that means that Israel's military occupation of the West Bank and Gaza was 17 years old. The dispossession of his family's hometown in the Ramla district of Palestine was 36 years old, so he was born about perhaps a half hour, 40 minutes from your family's hometown, about. He grew up under military occupation, under what for many people were false hopes of the Oslo Accord, against which he's spoken out, been very, very critical of the Oslo Accords, against what he writes about as the division and despair that they've sown among Palestinians. He's witnessed Palestinian separation, Israel's suffocating siege of Gaza, and three ferocious Israeli wars on Gaza in the last 10 years that have left, among many, many other tolls, 53% of the population of Gaza living in poverty, which is defined as less than $4.6 a day. Two-thirds of those people who are living in poverty are also managing in the deep poverty of not having enough money to cover the very most basic needs of shelter, clothing, and food. In these dire circumstances, Ahmed Aburthema opened up a renewed path for Palestinian resistance, asking last year what would happen if thousands of Gazans, most of them refugees, attempted to peacefully cross the fence that separated Palestinians from their ancestral lands. The result of this bold proposition was the Great Return March. Since it began almost a year ago, Palestinians experiencing some of the most harsh, some of the harshest forms of Israeli repression, have led us all to imagine a better future through courageous, loving, persistent acts of resistance, day after day, week after week. The Great Return March is so deeply rooted in Palestinian histories of resistance, and in a beautiful way it has helped us to rebuild a Palestinian unity despite geographic separation, both in the way that you envisioned this protest, but also in the way that's mobilized Palestinians across so many different places. The Great Return March began with protests at the fence that separates Gazan families from their lands. And of course, also, this is a fence that's so important to think about what this really means. It's also a fence on one side of which live people who have a life expectancy 10 years longer than on the other side of the fence. So this is a fence for us to really think about racism and apartheid and death. The Land Day is a very important day in Palestinian tradition as well. Since 1976, Land Day has been a day of Palestinian protest and commemoration, marking a day when seven Palestinians in the Galilee, inside Israel, were killed by Israeli forces as they protested land confiscations. And Land Day has been marked every year since then as a way of practicing Palestinian connection to the land. And of course, it was also planned to mobilize Palestinians during the season of protest that occurs in one way or another every year between March 30th and Nakba Day of March 14th. And of course, last year was one of a pivotal year to commemorate the Nakba because it marked 70 years of Palestinian dispossession. And it's important to note that this protest builds on a heritage of Palestinian popular resistance, on the 1936-1939 Great Revolt against British rule, and on the 1987 to the early 90s Intifada against Israeli occupation. And of course, Palestinian popular resistance has gone on basically every day since the Nakba in one way or another. It also innovates on this tradition as well with a determination to build a new society in and around protest, with a role for nurses, for journalists, for teachers, for young and old, men and women, not only for flag flyers, but also kite flyers and balloon blowers, a mode of protest that invites families to join for picnics and then invites prayer to happen on that sacred ground of protest, of struggle and protest. The Great Return March links together so many issues at the core of the struggle for Palestinian rights, and in that way stands for all Palestinians. It helps us to think about and struggle against that deadly fence that separates Gazans from the rest of Palestinians and from, in many ways, from the rest of the world. The Palestinians in the Great Return March are standing in struggle against siege. They're struggling for the Palestinian right of return, for Palestinians' work for struggle for a better life with dignity, and a struggle against racism, this racism that allows Israel to treat Palestinians as if our lives matter less or don't matter at all. It's a struggle for Palestinians' ongoing relationship to our beautiful lands. And in struggling for justice in these most difficult circumstances, Palestinians in the Great Return March are a model for all of us, Palestinian or not, who see how integrally connected can be and should be global movements for a life free from racism, militarization, walls, poverty, and displacement. It's a model for all of us who are part of a global movement for a life in which communities can expect the next generation to grow up in a livable environment with freedom of movement and also the freedom to be rooted with dignity in our own homes and our own lands. So, you know, the Great March of Return has inspired Palestinians in Gaza, obviously in Gaza, but also in Haifa, in Ramallah, in Beirut, in many places around the world, and it's also surely inspired us as a community in Boston. Last year, we were honored to be able to read your words at our 70th commemoration of the Nakba. We felt the power of your organizing, of your resistance, of your determination to continue despite that day's horribly bloody news of Israel's repression of protest that day that left more than 58 people dead. And so I'm very, very grateful to be able to welcome you here to Cambridge and to Boston on behalf of the community. Thank you. And also to recognize the extraordinary organizing work of Jihad al-Muslim with the AFSC. Thank you. Sorry.
Good evening, Boston.
Good evening.
It is my pleasure. Can people hear me? It is my pleasure to be here with you today. I'm going to say a few words before I invite Ahmed to the stage. My name is Jihad Abu Salim. I'm from a small town called Deir al-Balah, 6 miles south of Gaza City. It's my hometown. It's where I grew up. It's where I spent most of my life. I've been in the U.S. for 5 years, and in those 5 years, I haven't been able to go at least once to Gaza and see my family. My siblings grew up, they became older, and I kind of no longer kind of recognize my dad when I FaceTime him every once in a while as age has grown on him. I would like to thank the organizers of this great event. I would like to honor the great work of those people who work tirelessly day and night, working with us, to make this moment possible and to allow us to be in this space with you all here tonight. Although I gave many talks and went to many lectures in the 5 years of my journey in America, this moment tonight feels like no other moment. I started working with AFSC in Chicago in summer of 2018. I was interviewed for the job back in March, and I had my orientation day on March 29th of that year. Around the time I was about to leave the office, I told my colleagues to be, tomorrow there will be a march of return in Gaza. What will that be about? What's the scale of it? These were questions that most of us didn't know the answers to. I couldn't sleep that night, as my brain was overwhelmed by thoughts about Gaza and about the people there, about the destiny of people who live with me on the same street, about people who I knew they will be going to the fence and might never return to their families and friends again. So the idea of marching for return has reverberated throughout Palestinian history. It's not a novel idea or a new one. But what the Great March of Return has done is that it revived this notion of moving from calling for the right of return to actually marching east to call for its implementation, because Palestinians do have the right to return to their towns and villages. The idea of marching, of having some sort of a mass popular mobilization in Gaza, started in summer of 2017 when Palestinians in Jerusalem had their uprising against the metal detectors that the Israeli authorities installed outside of Al-Aqsa Mosque. And that was a great moment for Palestinians, unprecedented in a long time, that thanks to mass popular mobilization, the masses in Jerusalem were capable of undoing the policies of the Israeli authorities. That inspired a conversation in Gaza that my friend Ahmed here was part of. And that conversation that happened mostly on social media. Social media is the front for where young people, intellectuals, young intellectuals, activists, academics, people who have no platform, talk and engage in these ideas. This is an idea that came from the grassroots. This is an idea that has been part of the Palestinian consciousness and part of the Palestinian discourse for many years, and it will still be there for many years to come. The events that unfolded in Gaza last year highlight two important issues that I would like all of us tonight to keep in mind. It highlighted the Palestinian refugee plight and the decade-long blockade on Gaza. There is a sense of urgency when it comes to the blockade, but also there are larger political questions that the march also hoped to raise our awareness on. We organized this tour at AFSC and working with our great partners and friends in order to bring this conversation back in Gaza that is under blockade, that is not supposed to be here according to the laws of occupation. We organized this tour so that this conversation can be here with you and so that you can be part of this conversation as well. So I invite you tonight with me and with my dear friends here to celebrate Ahmed's presence with us as an act of breaking the blockade on Gaza, and I invite you to listen, to open your heart and mind. No matter how you agree or disagree with the things he will say. After all, he was a prisoner, that he's just tasting a moment of freedom, and soon he will be back to the prison of Gaza to dwell with 2.2 million people in a prison that has never shown them mercy for the many years that passed. So let's open our hearts and minds. Let's listen. Let's listen and talk and ask questions with good faith and with love and with a hope in mind that after listening to his words, that one day with his words and with the actions of those who sacrifice their lives every day, that one day there will be a better future for all the people, not only in Palestine, but everywhere. Thank you so much, Anna, and please join me in welcoming Ahmed Abdel.
Good evening. At first, I would like to thank all the organizers of this great event. Thank you very much. Brothers and sisters, peace and blessing be upon you. In nearly every part of the world we live in, it's possible for one to decide to travel and then return home. I come to you from a place where living is subject to such extreme restrictions. One might spend years trying to travel without success. My being in front of you today is a personal success story. It's evidence of how lucky I am compared to many fellow Palestinians who never traveled even once in their lives. I came to you from Gaza Strip, which is a small part of Palestine. It's a narrow strip of land with an area of 141 miles, square miles. 2.2 million Palestinians live there, making it one of the highest population density territories in the world. 70% of the residents of the Gaza Strip are Palestinian refugees, expelled by Israel in 1948. My attempts to travel started 6 years ago, in 2013, and all efforts were not successful. I was always told that travel permits are only granted to patients who need necessary medical treatment. For students who seek to go to university, and for people with resident students who seek to return to countries in which they reside. I would say, I'm a human being who has the natural right to move freely. I want to explore the world and meet people from diverse cultures and countries. Isn't this enough of a justification for me to travel? The Gaza Strip links with the outside world throughout two crossings of Gaza residents. The first is in Rafah, south of Gaza on the border with Egypt. This crossing is known for its long delays. Many people wait months to leave. In 2017, for example, the Rafah crossing opened only for 29 days throughout the entire year. It was more often closed than open. The other crossing out of Gaza is Eretz in the north. Traveling through Eretz requires a special permit by the Israeli authorities, which they rarely grant. The sea borders Gaza from the west. The sea is completely controlled by the Israeli military ships. Although Israel claimed it withdrew from Gaza in 2005, no one is ever allowed to travel or leave Gaza by boat. Nor are Palestinians allowed to build the seaport which could connect them to the outside world. As for leaving Gaza by air, Israeli tanks and warplanes completely destroyed the Gaza airport in 2001, only 3 years after it was built. My first thought after I left Gaza was how happy I felt that I would be able to travel freely at last. It felt great to travel in the car without reading a sign that says, "The area in which you are allowed to move has ended." It was a beautiful feeling to move freely without seeing fences or walls. Dear sisters and brothers, on the 9th of December 2017, 3 days after President Trump announced he is going to move the embassy to occupied Jerusalem, I went for a walk with my friend Hassan near the fence separating the Gaza Strip from Israel. My friend Hassan pointed towards the east, saying, "Look, this is the fence separating us from our villages, from which our families were expelled." I was amazed that this fence imprisons 2.2 million people in the narrow Gaza Strip, preventing them from freedom of movement and a normal life. That night, I posted on my Facebook. It was the moment before sunset. I looked at the birds and I saw them moving between the trees on both sides of the fence, and no one stopped them. How easy the matter is. Birds decide to fly, so they fly. What if one of us imagine himself a bird and then decide to reach a tree beyond the fence? If that person was from Gaza or from West Bank, once they reach the fence, a bullet will hit his body. What's the business of this bullet to kill his dream as if he committed a crime? Why do we complicate the simple matters? Isn't it the right of humans to move freely like birds? What danger toward peace would a human create if he or she decided to wander in nature? On that day, I discovered the real reason to hate the occupation. I hate it because it disrupts my evening walk, because it's against the laws of nature. It kills my dreams. At the beginning of 2018, the Israeli blockade imposed on the Gaza Strip was making for Palestinians worse than ever. The destruction of health services, the cutting of employees' salaries, the paralyzed economy, and the continuation of the closure made life impossible. I wrote another Facebook post where I suggested that 200,000 Palestinians gather peacefully near the fence to demand a life with dignity and to return to their lands and homes. In this post, I said that we are people who want life and nothing but life. We die in our besieged narrow strip, so why don't we move before we all die? I ended this post with the proposed hashtag, Great March Return. Many people answered this call. They did so because 70% of Gaza's residents are refugees who were expelled by force from their villages and cities that are just beyond the fence. People answered this call because the Gaza Strip, according to the reports of the United Nations, won't be livable in 2020, just next year, because of the collapse of basic human services. People answer the call for peaceful protest because their desire for life was stronger than despair. The Great March represented a scream for life and a knock on the walls of the prison after these besieged prisoners decided not to accept continuation of a slow death. On March 30 last year, the day the Great March of Return was launched, tens of thousands of Palestinians peacefully protested near the fence. On that day, women, men, elderly and children together participated in the march and raised the keys of their houses in Israel. And Palestinians in Gaza still protest every Friday for almost a year. They raised the Palestinian flag and said, "We want to return. We want a dignified life. We want human rights like the rest of all people and nations of the world." What did Israel do to face those peaceful protesters? Israel opened fire at them and shot them with explosive live bullets, killing on that day and until this day more than 260 Palestinians. 25,000 more have been injured. Many of them lost their limbs. Among the victims of the return march were medics, journalists, and women and children. Maybe some of you heard the story of the paramedic Razan al-Najjar, who was killed by an Israeli bullet to her chest. Razan, a beautiful young woman, volunteered to help the wounded at the protests. She was wearing the white uniform of paramedic when she was killed. Somehow thinking that her uniform would protect her in the eyes of an Israeli sniper, the Israeli army killed Razan and killed her dream of a humane world where peace prevails. I visited Razan's mother, who told me about her angel daughter. She told me that she once asked Razan, What if you saw an injured Israeli soldier while you are helping the wounded Palestinians? Razan answered, I will help him with no hesitation. With no hesitation. My mission is humane and doesn't distinguish between people. Why does Israel target and kill peaceful protesters? Why? It kills them because it wants to target the will to live, the will to resist the occupation in the spirit of the Palestinian people. The protesters raised their voice after 70 years of attempts to silence us. The March of Return sends a message that millions of refugees must return simply because this is their right. The return of refugees is not theoretical proposition. It's also practically achievable. 85% of lands on which refugees lived before Israel expelled them in 1948 is still either empty or with low population density until now. If the world had the will, it would be able to put an end to the tragedy of those millions of refugees and compensate for their losses, making it possible for them to live in peace with their Jewish neighbors. We want a solution based on the foundation of justice, equality, and freedom. A country where indigenous Palestinians coexist with their Jewish neighbors according to the values of citizenship, equal rights, and the implementation of international justice. While the Jewish people have a right to live in peace and security, it's not fair or just to solve a tragedy by creating a new one. Sisters and brothers, Israel didn't only kill us since the beginning of the Great March of Return. Israel killed us first when it expelled our people by force from our villages and towns in 1948. Israel killed us again with military occupation in 1967. Israel killed us by imposing a blockade, depriving us from our most basic rights. And now we are killed. We are killed with explosive bullets when we decided to scream and say at the fence, no to death, we want our life. Can you imagine, my sisters and my brothers, can you imagine how people live in Gaza? If you were a young person in Gaza, you may turn 35 years old without ever getting a job, a place of your own to live, or be able to get married. To be a father in Gaza often means you feel ashamed because you are unable to provide food for your family and for your children. To be ill in Gaza means waiting for many months to get an Israeli permit in order to exit and receive medical treatment. To live in Gaza means that you will live without electricity We only have access 4 or 6 hours of electricity. Then it cuts off for 12 to 16 hours. To be a young person in Gaza means you spend your whole life without seeing a river, or a mountain, or a lake. You won't take the train, use an escalator, or connect with people from different countries and different cultures. You won't even see a civilian plane in the sky carrying passengers. Since I left Gaza, I'm still excited every time I see a plane in the sky. I stop and stare at the plane until it disappears in the horizon. In Gaza, we see planes in the sky, but only Israeli military planes. The sound of the plane is linked in the hearts of people to death and horror. It has hard for us to imagine that planes are symbols for life and activity. Israel claims the blockade of the Gaza Strip punishes a certain faction. But in fact, it's a policy of collective punishment against 2.2 million human beings. These crimes are committed by a state that it defines itself as a democratic state, then seeks to achieve its political ends by imposing collective punishment on patients, civilians, and children. Brothers and sisters, is it acceptable that entire nations remain imprisoned between walls and fences forever? Is it acceptable that relations between people remains defined by injustice committed by the powerful against the powerless, discriminating against them and depriving them of their rights? In a world of justice and equality, we could use our resources to build a better life for all and not for purposes of war and aggression. A world where people live connected and safe will be better for everyone. Will be better for everyone. Much better than a world of fences, walls, and fear. Let us stand in the right side of history for a better future for our children. We struggle today for freedom, dignity, and justice for all people. For all people. Thank you.
You have been listening to Ahmed Abu Ardama, a founder of the Great March of Return in Gaza. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.